For the week of March 1st, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 271, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And somewhere in the Pacific on the USS Common Carrier, I'm Michael Giltz.
Oh, I get what you're doing. Common Carrier, it's like an aircraft carrier, but it's also kind of a regulation of telecommunications regulation, which didn't start out as a telecommunications regulation, by the way.
But we'll learn all about that on this week's show from our guest, won't we?
That's right. We're going to be joined by Jonathan Strickland, a senior writer at How Stuff Works. He'll be helping us explain the new net neutrality rules the FCC voted on last week and exactly how it is we got here and why we keep talking about the subject. Maybe he can finally help us understand what net neutrality is, since everyone seems to be so confused by it. We'll also be reviewing the executive shuffles that have taken place at some of the big Hollywood studios over the past week. Apparently, Michael, the Oscars are over, and therefore everybody gets fired, or in some cases hired. Also, here's a question. Is Will Smith still a movie star? We think so. In fact, we kind of know so, and we've got the proof. We'll tell you about it. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we're looking at the weekend box office around the world, not just North America, but in China and Japan and Europe and everywhere. And the number one movie, according to RentTrack, is 50 Shades of Grey. It grossed $46 million over the weekend. It's at $486 million and counting. By next weekend, it will have passed the $500 million mark worldwide. It's playing in 60 territories. It's mostly a hit where the books were a hit, but it's also a hit in some places where they weren't, and also not doing great in some places where they were. But overall, it's big, it's front-loaded, people see it, and then they go home, and they don't want to see it again.
The question is, will they want to see the next one?
I think they will. And certainly if you keep the budgets, you know, 40, 60, 80 million, I figure by the third one, you know, when the two stars say, hey, can we have a little bit more money? I think you're still going to be making a lot of money. But they can check the profits around the world from RentTrack. That's where we pull our box office grosses. We also get info from The Hollywood Reporter, Variety, Box Office Mojo, Box Office Profits, The LA Times, everywhere we can find information on movie box office around the world. And number two around the world is Kingsman: The Secret Service, a sort of teenage James Bond, but it's not for kids. It's for adults. The Spy Kids, this ain't. Because Spy Kids did not end the way this movie ends. Good Lord.
Now, I haven't seen it, so don't tell me. I was.
Well, don't bring the kids.
Okay, but now, when you say it's for adults, it's not for adults the way, say, 50 Shades of Grey is
for
adults.
It's an R movie. Okay. It's probably a light R. Okay. But I wouldn't want to see it with my teenage kids. I'd be embarrassed.
Okay.
It's not actually. It's just just a few moments, but literally the finale of the film, the final kicker, is a little eyebrow raising. Let's just put it that way. People have talked about it, but good Lord, it's rather blunt and bizarre as far as I'm concerned. It's not a great movie. I wanted to turn my brain off, and it served the purpose. The lead guy was kind of appealing. I thought it would be a little better than it was. It wasn't as fun as Kick-Ass, but it did the trick for what I wanted that weekend. But it's not a terribly good movie. I don't particularly recommend it. But if you're in the mood for something mindless, it's perfectly serviceable. And there certainly will be a sequel, because Kingsman grossed $37 million over the weekend. It's at $210 million worldwide. It cost about $80 million to make. So it's going to triple its budget by next weekend. And so that's doing, and it's holding quite well. So this movie has had good word of mouth. It's the launch of a franchise, and I'm certain it will be the successful launch of one.
Right.
At number three around the world is the Will Smith con artist comedy. This is comedy, drama, really. It's Focus, and it grossed $31 million around the world. We'll talk about it more once we get into our movie notes. At number four is American Sniper, another $27 million. That's at $470 million worldwide. It's certainly about to pass the $500 million mark. Clint Eastwood's biggest film of his career as an actor or a director. By far the highest grossing Oscar-nominated film of the year. Practically grossed as much as all the others combined. At number five is SpongeBob SquarePants 2. I forget what it's called. Sponge Out of Water. That's what it's called. Another $25 million. That's at $236 million and counting. That's a little low, but you know, it's got a little ways to go, I would imagine. It's pretty much done in North America, but it's perhaps got some more territories to go overseas. At number six is Big Hero 6, the unexpected winner of Best Animated Film at the Oscars. It beat How to Train Your Dragon 2. It grossed another $22 million. And now it's at $570 million worldwide. At number seven, and here's the film to talk about, it's the Chow Yun-Fat film From Vegas to Macau 2, or as I've also seen it named, The Man from Macau 2. It grossed $22 million. It's passed $108 million worldwide. It's in about five territories. Primarily, it was a big box office grosser in China. And why is that notable? Because in February, for the first time in history, China grossed more in the month of February than the United States.
Yeah, well, that was bound to happen at some point. I think it's because it's a short month.
It's a short month, but they both had a short month.
It's also, you know, the Lunar New Year, the Chinese
New
Year.
There you go. Yeah. That's the big reason, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's much funnier to say it's a short month.
Yes, just like North America has a huge couple weeks around Christmas and New Year's, around the holidays in North America in December, China has big movie going time in February because of the Lunar New Year. And so in the month of February, China grossed $650 million and the United States grossed $640 million. You notice we said the U.S. and not North America. Why is that, Sperling?
Because
Canada made more money. If you put North America as one market, actually China has not beaten the North American market yet. But hey, that's a perfectly fair distinction to make. Canada added in another $70 million. So for the month, the North American market was slightly ahead at $710 million. But China beat the U.S. in February. Pretty soon it's going to beat the U.S. in February, March, April, May, June, and on and on and on in a few years down the road, because China has three times as many people. It's only reasonable.
But you know what? We'll always have more Starbucks.
Well, you may be right. At number eight is Wolf Totem, another Chinese drama. That's the one directed by Jean-Jacques Annaud. That hit $72 million worldwide. At nine, another Chinese drama. Again, it's the Lunar New Year, so a lot of big movies have been opening up there. This is Dragon Blade, which got a good review. I think it was Variety. It was one of the trade papers. It stars Jackie Chan as well as John Cusack and Adrian Brody. John Cusack, if you look at his movies in the last few years, he works a lot, but he doesn't make a lot of movies that have made a good impression in North America, and he just signed to a new talent agency. So there's a guy looking to restart his career and, you know, get something going. That I understand. You know, things aren't going right. You make a change in management. It's hard. You develop relationships with these people. But, you know, he's clearly fallen into a trough. But then I look at the kid from The Flash, which is the hottest show on the CW. And he just signed to the William Morris Agency, or William Morris Endeavor, I guess, right? Is that how it is?
Yes.
Yeah. And I'm like, really? You just hit it big and you're changing agents?
That actually happens quite frequently.
I find that depressing.
Well, yeah. And there are agents and agencies in town in New York and Los Angeles who represent talent kind of on their way up. They're known for representing up and coming talent or talent that may have be a little bit, I don't want to say past their prime, but they're not working.
They're
as
in a new stage of their career.
They're not working as frequently anymore.
They're not making the big movies with big money.
Right. And so, you know, Don Buchwald and Associates, Paradigm has been, actually, they're kind of on the rise. Gersh Agency was known for that for years. But effectively, what they're doing is that they're finding these talent, and it's so easy to steal them away that they know at some point that if one of their stars make it big, and they really are trying to get to that point with most of their talent, that they're going to leave because they can't actually service the actors and actresses.
Really? They can't do it? Or the person just moves on and jumps to somebody bigger with more flash? Because to me, I'm just a rube from the town. I'm like, hey, you brought me to the game. Why don't I show a little loyalty? And instead, I dump you the first second I get success. To me, that just feels, you know, petty. And to me, it reflects poorly on the actor. But what do I know?
But, you know,
you're saying it's more like going from the minors to the majors and they don't even expect you to stay with them. Is that really the case?
Well, they would like it. But everybody knew, for instance, there was an actor. I'll mention his name, Ryan Phillippe. And I knew, and everybody knew that the agent he was with, and I worked at the agency at the time that represented him, that he was in this movie. It was a Ridley Scott movie, a sailing movie. I can't remember the name of the movie, but he was getting a lot of attention and a lot of heat.
White Squall, I think.
Yes, like he was in White Squall, and then another movie after that.
A lot of hot young male actors were in that.
And we all knew it was just a matter of time probably a year or two. It lasted 6 months. He was gone within 6 months. And it's because when you're packaging movies at Creative Artists Agency or William Morris Endeavor or ICM or any one of these big agencies like UTA, it's very difficult if you're represented by an agency that isn't in that packaging mode. You kind of get cut out.
So you're just saying, well, to me, it just looks like bad loyalty. Is it? What about managers?
Managers are usually there for the long haul. They're usually there, and they play a very tricky role because, you know, when Ryan Phillippe or whoever it is goes from agent A to agent B, agent A usually calls the manager and says, "You couldn't have helped me out here."
Well, that's what's happening to John Cusack. Unlike a young rising star, he's just in a career trough. And, you know, if he's not going to run for president, I'd love to see him have a better career. So hopefully he'll restart things. But that movie, Dragon Blade, is doing
well
overseas.
President?
People were trying to get him to run for political office at one point.
Could you imagine, like, the speech that he would give? Like, you know, like that speech.
I love it. He's a smart, interesting guy.
In that speech and Say Anything, where he's like, I don't want to buy anything that's sold or processed. I don't want to process anything that's sold or bought.
And that's why he didn't run for office. At number 10 is The Lazarus Effect, which is a horror film. It only costs about $3 million to make. It opened to $10 million in North America. Everybody's happy, except for the reviews. At number 11, My Mom is Excited, the second best exotic Marigold Hotel. One of the best sequel names I've heard in a while. That opened mostly in the UK. Maybe that's Scotland and Ireland. It says three territories, but I think it's primarily the UK, and it opened strongly, $9.4 million in its opening weekend. My mom is ready. She's lined up at the box office. Star Wars has nothing on this movie. She's ready to see the sequel.
I thought you said the best sequel name you've heard in a long time was Dumb and Dumber 2, but instead of a number 2 or T-O-O, it was just T-O. Get it?
Dumb and Dumber 2.
Yeah.
Certainly better than anything in the movie.
No!
At number 12 is McFarland USA, another film from Kevin Costner. This is a Disney film, and it's showing good legs. It's doing quite well in North America. It grossed about $8 million over the weekend, holding pretty well. It's at $22 million and counting. Birdman, right off its Oscar triumph, grossed another $7 million. It's clawing its way to $100 million worldwide. It's at $86 million and counting. It'll get there. And number 14 is The Imitation Game. That's at about to hit $200 million worldwide. And at number 15 is another North American film that's doing pretty well, hold well in its second week, and it's called The Duff. And it's a high school comedy, better than your average comedy, I guess. And it's about to pass $21 million. It grossed $7 million over the weekend.
Well, now you wanted to return to Focus, this Will Smith movie, which, what did it earn this week? I've already forgotten.
It grossed just under $20 million
in
North
US.
America.
Sorry.
It's the first weekend, I think, since late October of last year that at least one movie did not gross $20 million. So there was a long run of movies grossing at least that amount, and the streak has ended. I don't know what the record is, but Focus earned just under $20 million.
And it got good reviews. Every review I read of it, okay, I read three reviews, but they all were good.
I don't know how it did in the reviews. I wasn't really focused on that. It did not get good reviews particularly, at least according to Rotten Tomatoes, it's at 55%.
Oh, okay, never mind. I take everything back.
But what I don't understand is why there was suddenly a rash of stories in the press about, oh, is Will Smith a movie star? Can he prove himself? He's on the ropes. I wonder if he'll make it. Now, I understand why, like, I don't know, blogs and silly little things might do that because his last movie, After Earth, was a flop, didn't do well. But I don't understand why it was in the trades. I don't understand why the New York Times had it. In their weekend box office roundup, they said, quote, Will Smith will have to wait for another movie to vanquish concerns about his popularity among moviegoers, end quote. And their takeaway from the weekend was, well, the movie did okay. It didn't do great. It didn't do poorly. And so the jury's still out on Will Smith. What? How did this come about? One movie and suddenly we're questioning whether he's a movie star? What happened? Do people just have short attention spans?
I'm sorry, what were we talking about? Get exactly. It? Because that's a short attention span.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, I can understand somebody tweeting it, but I don't understand why the New York Times and Variety and the Hollywood Reporter have suddenly lost their ability to understand how the movie industry works.
Well, because when Will Smith shows up to star in your movie, he's not saying, yeah, just give me a couple $1,000, I'll be there.
Yes, he does. He does that all the time. He's had a string of movies where he's taken less than a big amount, and they've still made a lot of money worldwide. He didn't get a big payday for The Pursuit of Happiness. He didn't get a big payday for this movie. He's actually diversified his portfolio a lot in the last 10 years. In fact, if you look at his career, back in the late 90s to early 2000s, he had five movies, and four of them were big flops. Those were Wild Wild West, The Legend of Bagger Vance, which was as much Matt Damon as him, Ali, which I believe he got an Oscar nomination for, certainly deserved it, and Bad Boys 2. Only one movie, Men in Black 2, which got terrible reviews, actually did well. But in that run, I don't remember anybody saying, uh-oh, Will Smith's washed up. He's not a movie star. He just kept on making more and more movies. And since then, he's actually made he's made nine films that are very diverse. He's made dramas. He's made romance. He's made comedy, animated films, big franchise blockbusters where he does get a big payday. And of those nine films, eight were smash hits that at least tripled their budget. And they got really good reviews, much better reviews than he got early in his career. So why, if in the last 10 years you look at his hits, Shark Tale, Hitch, The Pursuit of Happiness, I Am Legend, Hancock, 7 Pounds, Men in Black 3, and I, Robot. Well, you know, not all of those are good movies, but they all made money.
Well, if you look at the part of it is, okay, so he did Hitch in 2005, right?
Yeah.
And it did fairly well.
It did great. It was, you know, the guy had not been allowed to make a romantic comedy. And you're like, why has this charming guy not made a romantic comedy? And well, it won't work overseas. Nobody will care. They won't watch it. He made it. And it did very well.
Pursuit of Happiness?
A serious drama that I think is the best film of his career. And that like quadrupled or quintupled its budget.
Okay.
It's a serious drama, great reviews. And he was very good in it.
And then in 2007, he made I Am Legend.
Mm-hmm. And that was a success as well.
Was it a success?
Commercially.
Okay, well, I mean, I guess...
what are we talking about? Are we talking about, he's never gotten great reviews as an actor.
Well, no, I'm trying to explain why some of these articles were written or why...
I Am Legend at least tripled its budget. I Am Legend cost... Let's see. I Am Legend cost about $150 million to make, and it grossed $585 million worldwide. Almost quadrupled its budget.
Okay.
That is a solid success.
And what about Hancock? Now, again, 2008 Hancock, 2007 I Am Legend.
Right. Hancock cost $150 million to make and right. grossed $624 million. The only confusion on that is why they didn't make a sequel.
Right. Well, because that was supposed to be like the beginning of a franchise. And it
quadrupled its budget.
Yeah. 7 Pounds, also 2008.
Right. 7 Pounds, A Labor of Love, just like The Pursuit of Happiness. Both movies cost about $55 million to make. 7 Pounds tripled its budget. The Pursuit of Happiness made six times its budget, $307 million. Both, you know, 7 Pounds didn't get great reviews, but it certainly made money. So if you look at him, when he makes big blockbusters, when he makes serious smaller films, when he makes romantic comedies like Hitch, no matter what he's doing in this last 10 years, he's working, he's succeeding, and he's making everybody money.
Now, what about, okay, so that's 2008. Four years, and so he kind of leaves off, right, on 7 Pounds. That's where he left off in his career.
And
right?
He's expanding into producing, which he did successfully with The Karate Kid and Annie, which is not a good movie, but it made money. And he's producing stuff on Broadway. The guy's at the top of his game. He's making every type of film. He's doing other things. He's stretching his wings, and he's succeeding commercially and often critically. And then he does, as people wanted, a Men in Black 3 film.
4 years later. So I think part of that is there's this what in Hollywood is considered a lifetime, even though I don't agree that that's, I mean, 4 years, you should be able to come back 4 years later and be able to do something. Men in Black 3, 4 years later, I think that's part of the issue is that he wasn't actually in front of the camera for 4 years. And when Men in Black 3, was that considered a success, really?
I wouldn't say it was considered a big success, but it certainly didn't lose money. It was certainly a box office draw. I mean, he tripled his budget. It cost $200 million to make, and it grossed over $600 million. So, you know, that's certainly not a blot on his career as a box office draw. When you say, is he a movie star?
I guess here's where it's also kind of like a close-to-home philosophy. The budget of Men in Black 3 was an estimated $200 to $225 million.
Right.
And it made $179 million in the U.S. So it's kind of, well, gee, you can't even make your money back in the U.S. Granted, a lot of movies don't make their money back in the U.S. But
sure, especially with the big ones.
Yeah, but one would hope that a movie like this would. However, when you make a sequel like 15 years after the last one, and I'm picking a number there, it was a long time after the last one.
But the big... the big knock against black actors is, oh, they can't open movies overseas. You can't put them in you can't put them in romance. You can't put them in drama. You can't make movies starring black people because they aren't worldwide box office draws. And Will Smith is an absolute stone cold worldwide box office draw no matter what he makes. So now you're going to blame him for making $450 million overseas in Men in Black 3 as if somehow that's bad. That's absurd. Hollywood doesn't care where it makes its money as long as it makes money. Was Men in Black 3 a massive, wonderful success that everybody's proud to have on the resume? No. But they wanted him to make it. He made it, and it certainly made them money. And frankly, you know, as far as being in front of the camera, he's been in front of the camera since, you know, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air in 1990. The guy was making movies and TV shows nonstop from 1990 to 2008 for 28 years. He took a few years off. Give him a break. And he wasn't exactly off. He was doing other stuff.
Well, and then he makes After Earth. That was the big disappointment. That was the big kind of...
That cost $130 million to make, and it doubled its budget. It made $250 million worldwide. It didn't do anything in North America. It did not do well overseas particularly. It was a disappointment. Was it a total disaster? Was it just nobody even walked in the door? No. Did they lose their shirt on it? No. Does he have a misfire after what's a decade of straight hits from what was the last flop before that? You have to go back to Ali, you know, back in 2001, which is more, it cost a lot to make, actually $100 million. But I mean, Ali and The Legend of Bagger Vance, got to go back 13 years to find movies that didn't do well for Will Smith. And suddenly you're saying he's a flop, he's a danger, he's not a movie star anymore? It makes no sense. I don't mind it from the general public, but I do find it bizarre when the New York Times and Variety and The Hollywood Reporter can't put in perspective one film that underperforms.
Well, I think a part of it, and just hear me out here, I think much like every newspaper will write a headline, what time do the Oscars start, so that they can throw it on their...
Well, not if they have any respect for them. But the Hollywood Reporter just won best, you know, news magazine or whatever. They won a top award for their journalism.
Well,
and yet when I get emails from them, it's like listicles.
Well, that's the web properties, and I'm not saying that they're very different. But the New York Times, L.A. Times, Hollywood Reporter, Deadline—they all did that. Why? SEO, search engine optimization. All of a sudden, you type in Will Smith. Guess what? You now have a media property that ranks because you wrote this article. Is Will Smith still a movie star? That's one of the reasons that these are written.
Well, and then they cheapen their brand because, you know, if they're suddenly given up the ability to know, they're writing articles questioning whether Will Smith is a movie star. This is the Hollywood Reporter and Variety. They don't know. They really are confused as to whether he's a movie star. Really? And looking at that track record, are you confused?
No, I think he's very much still a star. And quite honestly, I think what defines a movie star is somebody who can have a big career in one moment.
And they're going to have ups and downs, right?
Right, that they kind of wax and wane. Look at John Travolta. I mean, here's a guy who in the 70s, late 70s, huge movie star. 1981, he does Blowout.
Wasn't the disaster. It was really Moment to Moment or and some other stuff, I think.
Yeah. Then he disappears for literally more than 12 years, okay? Then along comes Pulp Fiction.
Look Who's Talking?
Okay, fine. Look Who's Talking. But he wasn't, was he?
He was the star.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, but really, let's face it. Everybody saw Pulp Fiction as his comeback.
Sure.
Okay.
Well, but in Hollywood, they would have seen Look Who's Talking as his comeback. That's what would... Hollywood is smarter than that, aren't they? Don't they say, oh, yeah, look.
I don't know.
People still want to see John Travolta in movies.
Well, I don't know. There's a lot of people right now who don't like the people who are running Hollywood.
Right, but I just expect them to be savvier. I understand why you want clickbait, but I think you cheapen your brand if you don't just use a headline to tease them in and then bait switch them and say, of course he's a movie star. I don't know. I think it's ridiculous. I would expect the newspaper of record and industry papers to be smarter. I would hope the studio heads are smarter.
Well, as I was just saying, a lot of people don't like the people who are running the Hollywood studios these days, especially the people who have hired them. Because they're now changing. Now, Amy Pascal, we talked about last week, she was the head of Sony Pictures Entertainment, along with Michael Lynton. Of course, there was the big cyber attack, not a hack. Well, you know, North Korean kerfuffle there at the end of last year. All those embarrassing emails came out, and let's face it, the studio wasn't doing very well. Her head was on the chopping block already, so, and her contract was up for negotiation that year. They let her go. She's got a big producing deal. She's going to be given the Spider-Man movies.
We already covered that. Keep
we already going. Covered that. So who comes in? Now, there was some talk about one of three people. One was Doug Belgrade, who's there right now, who's the president of production, I believe, and the president of, I can't remember, Columbia Pictures, I think he's the president of, or Michael DeLuca, who is there, who is the president of production, actually, or Tom Rothman, who was over there at the head of TriStar. Well, guess what? It was Tom Rothman.
So Tom Rothman is now the head of Sony Motion Picture Group.
Yes. Now, Michael Linton, who everybody thought, well, can he keep his job if Amy Pascal can't? Michael Linton was around when this whole thing went down. He is keeping his job. He got a contract extension, actually. He will be in charge alone this time without Amy Pascal, and Tom Rothman will report to him.
All right. And nobody wants to be the head of Paramount.
Well, Adam Goodman, who I actually went to school with, I went to NYU with, and we kind of...
Does that make you feel bad?
Make me feel bad, what? That he's running a studio? And I don't understand.
Don't worry. Everyone in my class is doing better than me, not just one guy.
Well, no, I mean, we kind of came up together. You know, we weren't friends or anything, but, you know, we knew each other. Mm-hmm. We knew each other once we moved to Los Angeles and were working in the industry. He was an assistant at DreamWorks. I was an assistant and worked my way up a creative artist agency in William Morris. There are certain tracks in Hollywood. If you stay on them, then you kind of, the longer you're there, the more likely you are to be in certain positions. Doug Belgrade, for instance, has been at Sony for 25 years. He's now the president of Columbia Pictures. Adam Goodman was with DreamWorks for eons as an assistant and then a creative executive and then a vice president. And then when DreamWorks left Paramount back in, I want to say 2011, or maybe it was 2009, whenever they left, Brad Gray, the head of Paramount, convinced Adam Goodman to stay on with Paramount as the head of the studio, the president of production.
And now he's gone.
Yeah. I mean, he was very capable. Adam Goodman was very capable of kind of bringing these big movies in, such as Transformers or World War Z, and now Mission Impossible 4, and now Mission Impossible 5. But they were always over schedule, over budget. There were always issues. And now, of course, we talked about this, I think, last week, that Mission Impossible 5 was halted.
Took a mini break.
Yeah, they're kind of looking for what's referred to as an ending, you know? So I think that between that, you know, this issue of keeping things in check and the slate being kind of weak and light, not weak, but very light. There aren't, I think the first movie this year for Paramount is in July. I think they wanted, I don't know. I think
so he wasn't riding herd well over the movies that he was making.
That's the best way to put it, especially these big blockbuster movies.
But, I mean, this guy's not the only one to have trouble being at top of Paramount. I mean, they've been having a revolving door there for years now, haven't they?
But
people are writing stories saying nobody wants to be the head of Paramount.
That's kind of what happens when you have Sherry Lansing. She was the head of Paramount for how long? I think 15 years. That's usually what happens when you have the head of a studio leave after that long a tenure.
Suddenly nobody else can stay on long because they've lost that consistency and suddenly they're flailing away.
Well, I think that it's not that they're flailing away. It's that it's hard to fill shoes like that when you're following in the footsteps of somebody who did it very successfully for as long as she did. And she was.
But hasn't it been a while now? When did she leave Paramount?
I think she left. I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at what they have this year, Paramount has The Hot Tub Time Machine and SpongeBob, the sequel, has done well. Project Almanac actually got a few good reviews and looks like it'll be a modest performer for them. Selma, of course, did quite well. It's not a big grosser, but, you know, that was a prestige picture. And now they've got the future of the rest of the year. Look, they've got Terminator, Mission Impossible 5, another Paranormal Activity, something called Scouts versus Zombies, which is like a big franchise. And then Monster Trucks and Rings. So, you know, they've got big movies, but it's certainly not a big slate. You've only got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 movies for the rest of the year. That's about one every 6 weeks.
And Sherry Lansing stepped down in 2004 after what...
Right, it's been a decade. I think you should recover by a decade.
True, and she was there 12 years. So, yeah, you're right. You should have recovered. I think a part of it is they brought Brad Gray in, and you're working with Sumner Redstone. I mean, who knows what the issue is over there.
Yeah, so they don't have a lot of movies on their slate either.
Now, you know, Tom...
Would you want to be the head of Paramount?
Not right now, no.
Really?
Well, Sumner Redstone, yeah, not right now. That is a... look, I wouldn't turn the job down.
Sumner
but,
is not well.
Yeah, there. And there's no secession line, and it's going to be a mess over there once Sumner Redstone passes away, because he's basically, he's the dictator. So there's always chaos when something like that, when a reign like that comes to an end.
Yeah, that's a big reign to have ending.
Yes. Now, Tom Rothman held the reins over there. For 18 years, he worked at 20th Century Fox, and I think he was the head of the studio for, 12 years with Jim Giannopoulos, and he helped shepherd a few movies that you may have heard of through the studio system, one called Avatar and the other called Titanic. So he's certainly used to big blockbuster films. He's got a reputation for being kind of a hot-tempered a bit. But he gets the job done. He also manages the bottom line quite well.
He didn't exactly ride herd on the budget of Titanic, though, did he?
Does anybody ride herd on James Cameron? I don't necessarily
know. They almost always go.
Yeah.
Record-breaking budget. Is Adam Goodman regretting the fact that he didn't stay with DreamWorks? I doubt it.
No, because DreamWorks has been looking for money ever since then. So not at all.
And now we have DreamWorks Animation to talk about, which is a spinoff from DreamWorks.
Yes. Now, when they did that, when they spun DreamWorks Animation off, I just shook my head and thought, why are they doing that? You know, an animation company, a standalone animation company, that can be tough, you know, because you have your down years, you have your up years. You need some hits in the live action realm to kind of help boost your profits and your revenue.
Or a lot of animation in TV, you know, lots of TV shows, something.
Yeah, it's it just
didn't work out.
No, and it seems to be working out less and less as time goes on. Especially now, they're taking a huge write down. DreamWorks Animation, How to Train Your Dragon 2, big success, lost the Oscar, and bad week for DreamWorks Animation. By the way, they not only did they not win the Oscar for How to Train Your Dragon 2, they lost out to Big Hero 6, but now they're taking this huge $250 million write down, including $50 million for Penguins of Madagascar. And even worse, in my opinion, is that they're selling their Glendale campus. The big building over there and the big, you know, compound in Glendale. It's beautiful. If you've ever been there, it's a phenomenal campus. They're selling it. And then for like, what, $400 million, they're going to lease it back. I apologize. $185 million is how much they are they're selling it for.
And that is a classic short-term fix, long-term problem.
You know,
you give up your headquarters and then lease it back immediately. That's a disaster long term. Terrible idea. And I mean, I don't mean for them necessarily at this moment in time because their options are few. But I'll tell you, it was funny. Right before the Oscars, I got a Hollywood Reporter. Bundled in that week's issue was a lavish booklet promoting How to Train Your Dragon 2. I was like, wow, that's a lot of money for this little giveaway to try and tout the movie right up there, feeling their oats. They want that Oscar, and then they lost it. That must have really hurt.
Yeah, I mean, it was a surprise, don't you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly the How to Train Your Dragon was the front runner.
I mean, I'm sure at the end of the day, the movie made money, so it's not a big deal that it lost an Oscar, but it would have helped.
Yeah, well, it's a big whoop. It didn't make as much money as it could have, but, you know.
You know, I wasn't actually planning on segueing us into Big Deal or Big Whoop, but you know what? I do think it is time for that segment. It's our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, when I cornered Michael on who should replace Jon Stewart, his instinct was to say husband and wife team Jason Jones and Samantha Bee should co-host, giving the show kind of a chance to mimic local news, chat shows like Live with Regis and Kathy Lee, and the dual anchors on all the morning news shows. Well, you know what? So much for that idea. The same day a sitcom of theirs was picked up by TBS, Jones announced he would be leaving The Daily Show. Thanks to miserable timing, Comedy Central has lost, in short order, Jon Stewart, Stephen Colbert, Jamie Oliver, and Jason Jones. Big Deal or Big Whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, it definitely limits one more option for them. The more I thought about that idea, which others have floated as well, I'm sure, of them as the dual anchors, it made a lot of sense. It was a way to be fresh and different. And I don't know why he would announce he was leaving. Maybe he was told flat out, yeah, you ain't going to be it.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't understand why else he would announce that day. I mean, he does have this 10-episode sitcom to TBS, but I don't think that would interfere. And it's also something that, you know, it's 10 episodes. You know, why quit your day job?
Precisely. I agree. You know, take some time off and get a fill-in host. That worked real well. Disney is getting back into the duck business. Scrooge McDuck, to be exact. Yes, the Disney XD channel is reviving the Emmy-winning series in 2017. The show will air on Disney XD channel, which I still have yet to find on my cable provider's little channel lineup.
I found it. That's where they have the Star Wars thing, which is actually pretty good.
Well, it's going to feature more adventures of the world's richest duck and his grandnephews, Huey, Dewey, and Louie. DuckTales is a key Disney property in many ways and drew upon the legacy of Carl Banks, who was the genius behind the Scrooge McDuck comic books. Drew, you get it? Did you see what I did there?
I did. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, okay, just checking.
It's a big deal. This is a really keystone property for Disney, I think. And I think they recognize that. This show started to air in 1987, which means they started it up probably in 1985, you know, if not earlier. And The Little Mermaid was still 2 years away from debuting. I mean, Disney Animation was showing signs of life thanks to The Fox and the Hound and The Great Mouse Detective. But, you know, 85 was the year of The Black Cauldron. That was a big flop. And they really needed to turn things around. And they invested heavily in this TV series. They did much better animation than you were seeing for a syndicated show back in the late, you know, the 80s. Sorry about that. They spent a lot of money on this show in syndication, which is something you didn't see in animation back in the 80s. Those were usually low rent affairs, and they made it a high quality, a high priority show. They put a lot of money into it. They rolled the dice, and this was really their first big success. I mean, this show was a big hit. It won Emmys. It established them critically again, as much as any of those earlier films did leading up to The Little Mermaid. It had its own feature film spinoff. I mean, this is a really big property. And really, it did really build on the legacy of Carl Banks, which is one of the great Disney properties, an artist who really made the Scrooge McDuck. It's a real collectible. So I think this is as much a crown jewel in their legacy as anything else you can name. And certainly as far as the retaking of Disney's animation crown back, it's just as important as The Little Mermaid.
Well, speaking of hits, yes, the new rap musical Hamilton is coming to Broadway, but not as soon as most observers predicted. The show will be taking a breather after its run at the Public and then transfer to Broadway in late summer. That means it won't qualify for this year's Tony Awards. Though quite a few musicals haven't opened yet, given the rave reviews, Hamilton was the frontrunner, if not the anointed one, when it came to the Tonys. In a surprisingly candid story in the New York Times, the lead producer admitted he really, 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 really wanted to keep the momentum going and make that Tony deadline, but the show's creators insisted the show needed work, and frankly, they needed some, what's the word I'm looking for? Oh yeah, rest. Creator Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote the book, music, and lyrics, as well as stars in it, as well as being the father of a brand new baby. I'm tired just writing about that and talking about it. Big deal or big whoop?
That's a very big deal for all the other shows opening this spring on Broadway. They're like, whoosh. Thank you, Jesus. And, you know, I got made fun of this week by some of my friends who listened to the show. They're like, ha ha, you said Hamilton was open. I just repeated what everybody said. I don't have any insider knowledge. I wasn't claiming. I'm just, everybody said, oh, they're going to move right to Broadway. But the deadline was tight and the producer wanted to do it, but I think it was the right call. The only thing I don't understand is Lin-Manuel Miranda said, yes, we're going to work on the show. We believe it can get better. The director said he believes it can get better. But they said, but don't worry, we're not going to cut any of the songs. I'm like, well, if it's not up for cutting a song here or there, you know, why are you ruling out the possibility of trimming this or that to make it better? I don't understand.
Michael, answer this question. It's your birthday and someone gives you a calfskin wallet. How do you react? Do you A, accept it? B, are you disappointed? C, do you accept it but report the person to the police? Or D, do you check it for money?
I'm not a replicant. I'm not a replicant.
That's right. I was quoting from the classic sci-fi film Blade Runner, where our hero, played by Harrison Ford, is trying to determine if someone he's interviewing is human or a robot.
Or Sean Young.
That's true. One of the most influential films of all time, Blade Runner has been seen in numerous editions over the years, but until now, there's never been a sequel. Well, that's changing. Harrison Ford is on board and insists the script is the best thing he's ever read. Ridley Scott is producing, but won't direct. It'll likely, what is his name? Denis Villeneuve? Yeah, Denis Villeneuve, who directed Jake Gyllenhaal and Hugh Jackman in Prisoners. Looks like it's going to him. Big deal or big whoop. Are you sure you're not a replicant? And is this a big deal or a big whoop? That's my question.
I'm almost certain I'm not a replicant, though, with implanted memories. Who can be sure? But it is a big whoop.
Oh.
Right? I mean, who cares? I mean, were you dying to see a sequel to Blade Runner? I wasn't. It's a complete film. Now, the script may be great, though, given the movies Harrison Ford has made over the last 10 or 15 years, he may not be the best judge right now of that, though he was once upon a time. You know, I'm excited for the new Star Wars reboot, especially since George Lucas ain't writing or directing. I'm not necessarily excited for the Blade Runner because I love that movie, and I don't think a sequel is a natural thing. It's been a long time. Maybe it's a great idea. I withhold judgment, and I'll certainly see it, but I'm not excited.
You know, I'm actually thinking of making a sequel to Citizen Kane. Do you think the actors are still available?
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah. On TV, Orange is the New Black. In the music industry, Friday is the new Tuesday. Hardcore music fans may know that in the U.S. and various other countries, Tuesday has often been the day new releases hit stores. The idea was to get albums in stores before kids came in on the weekend scouring for their favorite artists. That's become hopelessly outdated, especially since digital releases means an upsurge in piracy. Albums in Europe often come out on Fridays, while Americans had to wait until the following Tuesday, or of course, download a free digital copy right away. The reverse also happened. Now, after long consultations, the music industry around the world is focusing its efforts to make Friday the official worldwide release for new albums. Everyone, everywhere, will have access to legally buy music from superstar acts on the same day. Plus, Friday is when most people around the world get paid and thus have some disposable income to spend. Finally, acts using social media don't have to worry about trumpeting an album's availability to fans who have to wait days or weeks before they can actually buy a new CD. I'm sorry, what's a CD? Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. It's a reasonable step to take. They should have done it a long time ago. I like it when there's a sense of, hey, you know, go on Tuesdays to the record store. I liked that idea. And now, since music and movies and books and everything are a worldwide business, it makes sense to have a worldwide release date, whatever it may be. So I'm glad they're all in sync, whether it was Tuesday or Friday. I don't care. But I like the fact that they're all happening at the same time. And it means when Blur's new album comes out, which they just announced, I know to go to the store on Friday.
I'm sorry, you're going to go to where on Friday? Where exactly? What store are you going to?
I don't know. I don't know what store I would go to in New York City. Where would I go to buy a new Blur album? It wouldn't be easy, but by God, I'll do it.
You know, I have to say, I was like, okay, so they're being released on Friday. Let Amazon know, because where else can we buy these things? I don't know what the big deal is. No pun intended. Now, let's be clear. There is nothing Lady Gaga can't do. Even question her. Gaga has released massively successful pop albums. She's recorded a Grammy-winning duets album performing jazz standards with the legendary Tony Bennett. She did a vocally impressive tribute to The Sound of Music at the Academy Awards. And now you can add actress to her oeuvre because Gaga is going to have a key role in next season's American Horror Story. Big deal or big whoop?
Big deal.
What?
Not for any particular reason other than the fact that it's something she needed to do. Diversifying is a good idea. It doesn't come a moment too soon. Her debut album, The Fame, sold 15 million copies worldwide. Born This Way, 6 million. Art Pop, 2.5 million. Cheek to Cheek, which you would not expect to do that well, 500,000. So, you know, it's been a quick and steady decline for Lady Gaga. So I think branching out into acting is a smart idea.
Well, you know what they say. The faster you rise, the faster you fall. Not always the case, but if you can rise quick, you can fall quick.
That's certainly not the case for U2, is it?
No, that is not the case for U2, because speaking of album sales, maybe U2 wasn't so dumb after all. They gave away their new album for free on iTunes. Well, not exactly for free, but Apple paid them a big chunk of money, if you recall us reporting on that. But still, it went out to half a billion people. That's a billion with a B. The manner in which they gave it away annoyed some people, and their annoyance kind of annoyed Michael. But what happened to the actual music? What happened to it? Rolling Stone named it the album of the year.
Pshaw.
And now a new independent study says that in January of 2015, more iOS device owners listened to music from U2 than any other artist. The Cantor Group did a survey and found that 95% of those iOS users listened to at least one track from the album Songs of Innocence in January. That same month, 23% of all music that iOS users listened to was by U2, well ahead of Taylor Swift, who accounted for 11% of all music played, with Katy Perry, Maroon 5, and Rihanna close behind. Big deal or big whoop?
Golly, it couldn't be more of a big whoop, could it? A survey by a group who did a telephone poll of people that claims people listened to the album that they were given for free.
Okay. Oh, wait a second. I thought it was done, like, electronically.
How could it be done electronically? No, it wasn't measurements. It was not a measurement. It's a survey.
Ugh.
It's not Apple telling us facts, which would actually be a big deal because it would be facts and data that we could pay attention to. It's just a survey. And thus open to all sorts of interpretation and confusion as to who they reached and how the questions were phrased and so on and so forth.
I know you are, but what am I? If you know the answer to that question, then you're a fan of Pee Wee Herman. Good news, kids. Pee Wee Herman's long rumored. Shouldn't we be doing this in Pee Wee Herman's voice?
Please don't. Please okay. don't.
Pee Wee Herman's long rumored movie is finally happening. Yeah, exactly. Produced by Judd Apatow, the film is called Pee-wee's Big Holiday, which is not a Christmas-themed movie, but in fact about the hardworking Pee-wee taking his first vacation on Flag Day. I made that last part up, the Flag Day part. Running the Playhouse can be awfully difficult, you know. The movie is directed by TV vet John Lee, who has worked on Broad City and Inside Amy Schumer. Just to prove he's cool, Pee-wee's movie will debut worldwide on Netflix, which also features two Pee-wee movies, the HBO special, and the first two seasons of his Emmy-winning TV series. No word on casting, but we can only hope Lawrence Fishburne has made room in his schedule. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop, I guess, right? Actor makes movie. I'm glad. It's Netflix. Do you think that's a sign that no studio wanted it? Or is it a sign that Netflix saw the value and made a deal that everybody thought this is a smart, safe bet?
And let's face it, Netflix is also known as the world's greatest babysitter.
So, yes, but I mean, wouldn't you want it if you're a Paramount? Wouldn't you want a new Pee-wee movie? I would. You don't think he's damaged goods, do you?
No.
I mean, he didn't harm anybody. It was masturbation.
Okay. Hey, you know what? It happened 20 years ago.
I know.
Nobody
exactly.
remembers it. And you know, this is a family show.
But why didn't the studio want this movie? Assuming that Netflix didn't outbid somebody. Clearly, there was no big competition because they kept hinting and hinting for ages that they were going to make an announcement. And ultimately, it was Netflix. I don't mean Netflix is, you know, last resort, but I don't understand why Paramount, who did the other two movies, didn't they? Why wouldn't they want it? It's not like their schedule is bursting with films.
I don't know. Well, maybe, wait, did Adam Goodman announce, or I guess he didn't announce, but did Paramount announce the departure of Adam Goodman, who will actually be moving over to a producing deal at Paramount? Did they announce that the same day?
He lost the Pee-wee movie. They said, you're out.
Exactly. Now, it has literally never happened before. A TV show debuts and its ratings increase in the second week, and then the third week, and then the fourth week. Yes, we're talking about the Fox hip-hop soap opera, Empire, and the explosive growth hasn't stopped yet. The show increased its overnight ratings for the seventh week in a row, and industry vets are struggling to discover any previous phenomenon they can compare it to. Just like Glee, the show is releasing a single every week or so on iTunes and will follow up with an album. Fox is even considering a concert series. Please don't. Empire
yes,
is the number one.
Don't.
Yeah, exactly.
God.
It's the number one show on Fox, and along with two editions of American Idol, is that network's only top 30 entry. It's up 39% from its premiere. That's the biggest leap in audience since the medical drama House over a decade ago. House ran for 8 seasons, by the way. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal.
It's huge.
It's a phenomenon. It's, you know, a top 10 show. It's number 9 for the week. That's kind of amazing. Nobody would have predicted. It is an absolute, you know, out of the box phenomenon. CSI, House, you know, shows like this don't come along very often. Will it burn out quickly? I imagine so, because it's a soap opera. And, you know, you're going to drive those ideas into the ground. I mean, Dallas ran for 10 or 12 years. But shows like this, you look at what happened to Glee, how they drove that into the ground, doing a concert series and all this stuff to make us hate the presence of the show because it's everywhere you can see it. What a terrible idea.
Yeah, there's something called milking it and cash cows, but you can actually kill your cash cow by overexposing it.
Absolutely.
Well, Michael, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, everybody's favorite segment. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, last week, the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, approved new rules which will regulate broadband internet service in a utility-like fashion, sort of, but not really. It's not really a utility. It's kind of complicated. We've been talking about this for what seems like forever. And if you think we've been talking about it forever, there's a reason. It's important to content providers. But it could have been much worse, since Jonathan Strickland is here to tell us that we could have been talking about common carrier regulation since the 1880s. Jonathan is a senior writer for How Stuff Works and hosts or narrates numerous popular podcasts, including Tech Stuff and The Stuff of Genius. We'll place links to all of his work in our show notes. We're happy he could join us today to help us understand the history behind all this talk of Title II and Common Carrier and how it all applies to net neutrality. Jonathan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. That was a great setup. That's fantastic. Yeah, we got to look all the way back to the 19th century, to the days of the railroads, to understand what's going on here, because...
Well, before we even get into that, I guess, Michael, you had a question, and it's a question every time we talk about net neutrality. Michael's not very technical. And Michael, what you always ask me one thing about net neutrality. What is that?
Well, this is something I've been asked all week long. What the heck is net neutrality? People don't understand whether it's a particular regulation you have to put in place and then you're done, or is it a philosophy that will guide how we regulate the internet and that it's a process that is ongoing. So just to explain to people, what exactly is net neutrality and are we done? Have we solved it?
Let me answer the second one first. We're nowhere close to being done, but it is a philosophy. It is a collection of ideas. And from a concept point of view, it's a beautiful thing. The idea is that net neutrality covers this whole umbrella of topics that involve the way we connect to the internet and the kind of content we can access. So in an ideal world, you would be able to connect to the internet using any capable device with no restrictions, and you'd be able to access any content that's on the internet regardless of where it came from, as long as it's legal. I mean, obviously, there are some limits even to net neutrality, but that's the case for net neutrality. And the reason why you have people asking for regulations is that without regulations, the only thing guaranteed neutrality right now is this tacit agreement among all the big players who are essentially saying, we're going to allow content that is not ours to pass over our network so that you will allow the content that's from us to pass over your network. And as long as this agreement stands in place, everyone's happy. But it's a very kind of tenuous agreement.
Well, and I guess way back in 2010, in April of 2010, and this is the current kind of kerfuffle about net neutrality. This is where it all started from during this go-round. Comcast and the FCC went to court because Comcast was faulted for kind of blocking BitTorrent packets or blocking BitTorrent traffic. And they were blocking apparently legal BitTorrent traffic. There's a lot of illegal BitTorrent traffic, as we all know. And the FCC couldn't... The court basically told the FCC, look, you can't simply just rely on Title I of the Communications Act to regulate this or to enforce net neutrality. They basically said, we're not telling you that you can't really tell Comcast what to do. You just can't. You have to find a better way to do it. So that led to the FCC under Julius Genachowski in November of 2011, kind of putting these open internet rules into place under Section 706 of the
telecommunications. Oh my gosh.
Well, this is important.
All right.
Because it all leads to what happened over the last couple of months. Basically, Julius Genachowski and the FCC tried to instrict or enforce net neutrality through these open internet rules But Verizon didn't like that, so they went to court. And in January of 2014, you might recall we talked about it at the time, the court said, yeah, no, you can't do this, FCC, because you don't have the authority to do so under Title I. However, there are a couple of ways you can do this, and they kind of pointed to Title II, and that's where we wound up. But it really all boils down to common carrier laws. And Jonathan, how did those laws start?
Okay, you got to go back to the 1800s and the railroads, because the term common carrier, as you would imagine, refers to carrying people and cargo, not necessarily just information. And in those days, there was a real worry that railroad companies had effective monopolies and that they could do things like choose to charge one person one rate from a city and another person from that same city a totally different rate because they were aware that person could afford it. And the government stepped in and said, all right, this is not acceptable. We're going to create some regulations to make sure that everything is just and reasonable. And that's a term you're going to hear over and over again, just and reasonable. So that's where they started setting up the terms for what a common carrier is supposed to do.
And it wasn't a worry. I mean, that was what railroads were doing. They were giving some companies monopolies. They were giving discount rates to some so that others could never enter into a business because they couldn't transport their materials or resources from one part of the country to another at an equitable rate. The one company would get, like U.S. Steel or somebody involved in lumber, would get a great rate. And nobody else could enter in and compete with them because they could never get a similar rate and therefore could never start their business and compete on a national scale.
Right. And so early in those days, that's when the government stepped in and said, here are some rules. The rule is that you can't charge different people different rates. You have to give everyone the same rate from whatever city. Obviously, city to city, it could change. But within a city, you had to give all companies, all people the same deal. With one possible exception, if something was potentially hazardous, then a company could charge more for the transportation of that. But otherwise, you had to give everyone the same deal. And as long as there's capacity for carrying someone, as long as they have the money to pay for that passage, and as long as there are no reasonable purposes for denying that person transportation, then you have to accept them. And that's the basis for common carriers. And when the telegraph and telephone companies began to rise in prominence, instead of creating new rules for this new type of communication system, Congress decided to stick with the rules from the railroad companies and just apply them to telephone and telegraph companies. That's what's evolved over time to cover the internet as well.
Well, I guess it was in 1934 is when the FCC first kind of, well, that's when it was formed, right?
Yeah, that was formed during the Communications Act of 1934, which established the Title II we're talking about. Title II essentially groups together anything that falls into this common carrier category. Title I would be unregulated types of transportation. Title II is regulated.
But then what happened once, because Title II at the time in 1934, there was no data going over phone lines. It was just voice. But then I guess at some point we started sending faxes over phone lines and modems, and the FCC probably had to step in at that point.
Sure. Yeah. In fact, well, in the early days, the whole reason for it was because not all local phone companies were compatible with other phone networks. And so there had to be this regulation to step in so that we could have the guarantee that everyone would have access to this this utility and be able to contact anyone else. And also that you didn't have to pay extra fees to make sure your message went through. That was a real problem with the old telegraph companies. As the services evolved, the FCC also had to adapt with that. And you get up to the Telecommunications Act, which was passed in the 90s. That was to try and address some of these other growing and evolving concerns that went beyond just voice communication.
And that was that, I guess, this is where what we know as net neutrality today, the Telecommunications Act, this was Bill Clinton's big information superhighway bill. That's where net neutrality as we know it today started to kind of come to the fore and evolve.
This is where Section 706 of the Telecommunications Act, this is where that comes in. That laid out that there had to be a timely deployment of telecommunications capability. That has recently come back in a big way with an FCC decision, one that was as big in a way as the net neutrality decision. Before the net neutrality decision was handed down, the FCC voted 3-2, which is the same vote for net neutrality. They voted 3-2 that they would overrule state laws or two instances where states had had restricted municipal Wi-Fi, municipal broadband. And the FCC has overruled those state laws by citing Section 706, saying that it violates the deployment of telecommunications capability in a timely fashion. And all of this together is what is causing such a ruckus right now.
Okay, so that actually, I would agree with you, because the whole concept of net neutrality, yes, okay, so that's what was decided second on Thursday of last week. But what was decided first and voted on first was this whole concept that, I mean, right now there's no competition in certain areas because the cable companies have come in and they've pretty much monopolized broadband. And so places like Chattanooga and places, I can't remember, I think Philadelphia tried it. Certain municipalities tried to lay out their own broadband, much the way the electric company, well, actually electric companies are privatized in most places, but the, you know, water isn't in many instances. They tried to build their own broadband network, and they, these, you know, Verizons and Comcasts and Time Warners, they went and lobbied and got these municipalities and states to outlaw it. So in 19 states or 20 states right now, you cannot, if you are a town, a village, a city, create your own broadband network to compete with cable providers. And part of the issue was, while content is free to travel over telephone lines, or not free, but, you know, you have to be a common carrier if you're sending data over a telephone line, that is not true of cable. So that's where net neutrality comes in. Meanwhile, you have no competition in actually laying out cable, which is where most content and most data is being transferred today.
Right, right. Yeah, some of the arguments against it were that there had been projects in the past where municipalities had raised taxes in order to create Wi-Fi zones where the plans had not worked out. And that became sort of the justification for saying, let's pass laws to prevent it. This is to protect the taxpayer so that the taxpayer's not paying for a project that never ends up benefiting the people who live there, the citizens. And there's something to be said about that, but
not,
I think that
much.
That was being used as a veil.
Yeah.
Not much to be said about that. I mean, if we're going to look at history, of course, as you would know, if you look at electricity and telephone lines, if you just let big business decide, they're not going to spend the money or energy to reach people in rural areas. They simply
sure.
wouldn't. And the government had to step in and say, no, we need to electrify the entire country. We need to get telephone lines to the entire country. And nowadays, they're going to say, we need to get the internet to the entire country. And essentially, there is very little to no competition for high-speed broadband internet. If you're lucky, you have two options. And that's why Americans' internet is slow and expensive compared to the rest of the first world. Isn't that right?
But no, you are exactly right. And one of the things we hope for with the regulation side is that it will allow true competitors to come in, competitors like Google, to lay out Google Fiber in a faster, more accessible way. For one thing, there are some areas where Google Fiber has real problems getting access to utility poles. And these are poles that other providers like Comcast or AT&T or Time Warner, they have full access to it. So the hope is that by turning this into a regulated common carrier, players like Google will be able to have that equal access, and thus consumers will start to have true competition. Because as you point out, in a lot of areas, there is very little to effectively no competition in that space.
Well, and so what that we're talking about right of way, and this is, in my opinion, you know, the Broadband providers, AT&T, Comcast, Verizon, and even the NCTA, the National Cable Television Association, they spent, I think, upwards nearly $70 million last year alone lobbying both the FCC and Congress to try and prevent all of these net neutrality rules from being put into place. And I think that the whole right-of-way and what's called a poll charge, you mentioned polls, and it's a poll charge. They're actually going to regulate the rates for pole attachments, and that's really the issue that I think is far more important, because now all of a sudden, if you're, I don't know, John Doe internet service provider, you can actually turn to Time Warner Cable or Comcast and say, well, you know, customer A, who's in your zone there, and you've laid wire into that person's house or apartment or residence, they want broadband, but they want it from me. I'm going to use your right-of-way, your lines, and you will charge me for that a reasonable rate.
And the problem here is that reasonable rates, I mean, that's one of those things that has to be established essentially in court cases. So a reasonable rate, you know, there's another case here that we can talk about where you're talking about transit fees. Transit fees are where you have companies that are dealing with traffic on the internet, but they don't take it to the last mile. That last mile is what is handled by your internet service provider like Comcast, Time Warner, Google Fiber, whatever it may be. And you have these interconnection fees that could potentially be part of that. We saw that with Netflix. Netflix had to pay interconnection fees with the large carriers, the large internet service providers, in order to get direct access to send information from their network to consumers. As long as those rates remain mostly by the determination of the parties involved, everything works fine. It's when companies, one party or the other, starts to protest and take it into court, that this is going to get really messy, and we have to start defining, well, what exactly is reasonable?
Yeah, so Jonathan, ask me a question. If I'm a company and I develop 3D, 4K, or 8K live streaming 24-hour-a-day video that people like to have in their homes up constantly, and suddenly I'm using bandwidth to an extraordinary amount, explain who pays for that and how and why some companies shouldn't be able to say, hey, you should pay more because you're using up a lot more of our bandwidth.
So the answer to that is that pretty much everyone pays. You've got the consumer paying for the connection fee and presumably for the service in some way. You've got the provider that's usually paying some sort of interconnection fee or transit fee. So if it's a large enough provider like Netflix, they are large enough where they can deal directly with the internet service providers, the last mile. So if they're large enough, that's where that interconnection fee is going to come into play. And it's going to come into play for all the major players. So Comcast, Time Warner, all that kind of stuff. If they're not a major player, then you have transit fees you would have to pay for the backbone servers, the companies that actually oversee the connections of the network of networks. So this would be the kind of the highway between the provider and that last mile. Plus, you'd have the last mile to come into play. There are some who have been saying that net neutrality is all about making sure that all data is treated equally and that everything is going to be given the same priority. And the doom and gloom people say, well, that means everything's going to be slow. If everything gets the same priority, then Johnny down the street, who's watching 8K 3D, is faster, going to end up taking up so much of that bandwidth that your emails and voice calls and everything are going to be slowed down. You're going to be dropping packets, kind of like I've been through this interview where I just drop packets left and right. But that could be, that could become the norm according to the doom and gloom. There's still a provision there for reasonable network management. I don't think that's really going to be an issue, at least not in the short term. And the hope is that we will continue to roll out infrastructure to deal with the increased bandwidth requirements over the long term.
And a company like Netflix pays a lot of money and builds a lot of structure in their home base to handle high traffic and the video that they're sending out. So when people say, well, they should have to pay more, well, they are paying more to make sure their service works properly on their end. And consumers pay on their end. So it's, the question is, why should they pay twice? Just because, you know, they're providing a video rather than music or something else.
Right. And they actually ran into this last year. Netflix originally, in order to avoid the interconnection fees, they were sending their traffic through transit networks that then carried that information on to the last mile. So it was essentially going like a middleman in between Netflix and the ISPs. But consumers were having buffering times. They were having errors while they were waiting for stuff to load. And so eventually Netflix kind of caved and paid for those interconnection fees, which increased the speed of delivery tenfold. And people started getting their movies and everyone was happy. And even Netflix has said that the expense of the interconnection fees, while they would prefer to pay nothing, obviously, while that expense is there, it pales in comparison to the amount they spend on content.
So, Jonathan, what are you most excited by about the rulings that the FCC put into place today? Have they learned their lessons from history? Obviously, the competition seems long-term to be the most important part, the fact that they're opening the door for more competition on a municipal, local level.
That's the thing I'm most excited about. Living in Atlanta, I'm really excited about Google Fiber coming here, and I'm excited
I know.
Yeah, I'm really excited. Well, for one thing, I'll be able to have these conversations better. But another is that I'm really looking forward to seeing that get smoother, like the transition, the laying out of an infrastructure to be a more smooth process. So that and we're still talking about something that only huge companies can really compete in. So it's not like it's opened up the gateway for a nirvana of net access, but it has helped. As for what else I feel optimistic about, I feel optimistic that I will be having several power naps in my near future because they haven't yet published the 300 pages of rules yet. And I have a feeling that when I start reading them, I'm going to need lots of rest breaks.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I guess there's still, so these rules aren't in place yet. There's a whole process that the FCC goes through and there's some dissenting opinions. Those have to be addressed. And then 60 days. I mean, there's a whole process, and then of course the process of Verizon and Comcast and AT&T, somebody coming along and suing, trying to prevent this from happening.
Sure.
But what started out as a philosophy of net neutrality in a way is becoming net neutrality regulations.
Yeah, some people are leaping to the conclusion that regulation means government intervention. I would argue that's not necessarily the case. There are also people who point to the telephone companies and say, look, they haven't had any innovation in years and that's been regulated. But that was also effectively a monopoly. And when you're already everywhere and you own everything, there's not a lot of incentive to innovate. I think this is actually encouraging innovation by allowing for more competition in the space. And keeping consumers are actually getting aware of it for the first time in a long time. So I'm really excited about that.
Well, the issue with consumers is that, frankly, a lot of them don't understand it, which is why we continuously are talking about it. And it's great for you to stop by and try and help us understand it even more.
Oh, I very much appreciate it. Next time, I promise I'll have a hardwired connection.
Well, Jonathan Strickland from How Stuff Works, and of course, the popular podcast Tech Stuff and The Stuff of Genius, and as well as others, we'll place links to all of your work in the show notes, as well as how to follow you on Twitter and elsewhere. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us and tell us all about, well, net neutrality and the history of how we got here.
Thank you so much. Have me on anytime. I really enjoyed it.
Well, it's good of Jonathan to stop by. I like his podcast, Tech Stuff. And people obviously would have picked up on it while they were listening to the interview, assuming you don't cut all of it out. But we were having technical issues.
That's
right.
We were
having broadband internet connectivity issues. That stuff does not happen in Europe. We need more competition.
Now, the funny thing is, as you were saying the word connectivity, you dropped out, which I think is very funny. I think it's because we were talking about net neutrality. The second we started that, Time Warner said, that's it, throttle them.
Yeah, thank you, Time Warner Cable.
Exactly.
Something Leonard Nimoy will never have to deal with again.
That is true, and that's unfortunate. Leonard Nimoy, of course, the actor, writer, director, painter, photographer. He played Spock in Star Trek for years. I mean,
50 years he played that role, practically.
That's
you
right.
You know? Starting with the TV show, even the first pilot, he's the only person who was on the first pilot, The Cage, and that was kept into the when they redid the whole thing.
Oh,
so
wow.
He's been doing it for a long, long time. Video games, cartoons, TV shows, feature films, you name it.
Well, you know, he was actually scheduled on April 10th to do a conversation at the UCLA Performing Arts Center. So I guess, well, I know that's not going to happen now. But
of course it's not going to happen. Yes, you do know that. Was Jeff Boucher going to be, what was it? What was it tagged to?
I think a play that he had something to do with.
Ah, well, you know, he was a stage actor. I think his favorite role on stage was probably Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof. That was a good regional production. But as he said, as he told the LA Times in 1999, for whatever reason, I projected some kind of quality that people said, okay, he's a good alien. I mean, people bought him a Spock.
Yeah, no, and he was nominated, I think, I don't know if you mentioned that, nominated for every time he played it, 3 years, right?
Yeah, Best Supporting Actor nomination all 3 years on the show. He jumped right into Mission Impossible. Of all the actors on the show, he had the biggest early success post-Star Trek. You know, William Shatner, of course, had T.J. Hooker and has had a long and storied career on other dramas. And other actors have done stuff. But clearly, Spock and Leonard Nimoy was really the one that was launched. So he perhaps had hopes of an even more robust career than what he had. You know, you talk about what might have happened if he hadn't been stereotyped. Well, you know what? To find one role that makes you famous forever is a pretty rare thing. So to worry about what great career you might have had, you know, you might have just been obscure.
Yeah.
So you can't really lose sleep at night. And I don't think he lost sleep. He pretty much was summed it up in his two autobiographies. One he wrote in 1977 was called I Am Not Spock. And then he wrote another one in 1995 called I Am Spock.
Well,
so that pretty much sums it up.
Well, he was going to be in conversation at the Center for the Performing Arts at UCLA, in conversation with Christy Edmonds, mapping an artist's journey on April 10th, obviously not happening. What will happen is his play Vincent will be performed by Jean-Michel Richaud.
That's a one-man show about Vincent van Gogh. He wrote it, he starred in it, he's done it for many years. It's, I think, as early as the 70s or certainly that he'd been doing that thing. He also, you know, he did photography and artwork. Obviously, none of it particularly, you know, none of it was talked about except, I think, for the fact that he was famous already. But he did have some success as a director. He only agreed to make Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, if he could direct it. So he ended up directing at least two of the Star Trek films. And then he directed Three Men and a Baby, which was the biggest hit of its year in North America. It was a big hit film. But then after that, nothing else quite clicked. So, you know, he made some other movies as a director, but they never, you know, they never quite worked. He had a syndicated show In Search Of. But always, time and again, it would come back to Star Trek. There'd be another movie. He'd do another cameo. He would do a cameo on The Big Bang Theory. And he handled it with grace and, you know, class.
And his last tweet, his last post to Twitter, was on February 22nd. He was in the hospital and probably gravely ill at this point. Obviously, he passed away shortly thereafter, 5 days later. Was, a life is like a garden. Perfect moments can be had but not preserved. Except in memory. Live long and prosper.
Oh, that's very sweet.
Talk about prescient.
He knew he was dying, but he said, do not smoke.
Yes.
So kids, forget the naughty words you hear on the show, but just learn don't smoke because it's stupid.
But you know what's not stupid? Is when you subscribe to our show in iTunes.
And rate it.
Yes, please do subscribe, rate, and review the show in any podcast aggregator you can find, including ones we don't even know about, because it does help us out.
You know you haven't rated it. You go to iTunes, you click 5 stars, and you walk away. It's simple. It's easy. It's fun.
Yeah, or you could leave a little note saying, hey, guys. And you know what? We should start reading those. When people do that, we should start reading what they say or at least mentioning their
handles. Well, if they did it more, we will.
That's true.
You know, they're not doing it. And believe me, you can't tip us. We don't ask you for money. Make a big, big difference to raise the visibility of the show, both to Apple and the world, if you do that. Just takes a minute.
Or the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher, or wherever they give podcasts away for free. And Michael may not be asking you to pay him, but I am, actually. Please do pay us. Now, you can find that information, as well as links to all the stories we've discussed on today's episode. They can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. We're also going to be placing links to Jonathan Strickland's work in our show notes, and I'd like to thank him for joining us to talk about net neutrality. You can also write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. all of this information, ways to follow us at Twitter is our at Twitter is not our handle on Twitter, but it is at Showbiz Sandbox, and Facebook.com/Showbiz Sandbox is where our page can be found. So you can like us there. So all of this information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is MGMT.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
It's Of Course Will Smith is a Star.com.
Oh, okay. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's writing on the entertainment industry there, try, say, the Huffington Post or MichaelGiltz.com, or head on over to BookFilter.com. Some of my writing can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.